Our special guest tonight, Stephen Schwartz. We're going to take your phone calls, your stories in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Stephen Schwartz with us talking about his book, The Eight Laws of Change. When you worked on these eight laws, Stephen, how did you come up with this? Why not seven? Why not nine? Are you there? Nope. Need to call him back, Donna, because he is gone, but we'll get him. He was working on law number nine, maybe, of change. Who knows? Hey, nonetheless, we've got the calls, so we're going to take calls right now. Mike in Cleveland, Ohio, on the wildcard line. Go ahead, Mike.
Hey, good morning, George. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. We don't have Stephen back yet, but you have me.
Oh, that's okay.
He's back. He's back. Stephen, you're back, right?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay. Where'd you go?
I was cut off.
Huh, just disappeared. Okay. But anyways, we've got Mike on the phone. Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, yeah, Stephen, I agree with most all of your laws, but I wonder how you feel about the threat of intense civil disobedience in a political situation and something like that. I was involved in a residence group where the city wasn't taking care of environmental concerns. We all got together and talked, but they thought I was too young at the time. But basically, I pretty much stated about six of your rules to them in the first meeting. But they thought I was too young, and even though they kind of adopted most all the rules, they kind of fractionalized with the hierarchy, and then the city tried to split them up. And I kind of made that call to the ward council person with the city, stating that, you know, I'll just get right back in the game, and we can really have some intense, civil disobedience. And everything straightened out, and they did the right thing.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. But, I mean, as you've already learned, I mean, first of all, whatever it was you were doing, I mean, this whatever the project was, you provoked people into response. I mean, if you go back and look at the American Civil Rights Movement, I mean, I was involved in it from the 50s and up to the signing of the Voting Rights Act and beyond, but particularly the 50s and 60s. You can see how it happened. I mean, there were people who were attacked, and they just kept coming, and they did not respond violently. And ultimately, they compelled even these incredibly, these old racists who were just adamant about not letting racial equality take hold, they eventually lost. And today, I mean, people that are, I guess, under about 50 don't even know this story. But as you experienced in your own life, you worked out the laws and saw them and put them to work. The fact that you were young and people didn't pay attention to you, that's a comment on them, not on you.
Stephen, I was talking to you before you fell off, or once you fell off. Why not seven laws or nine laws? How'd you come up with eight?
I didn't. As I said, I did not invent these. I didn't come up with them. What I did was I got interested in this, George, because, as I said earlier, I have been involved with changing history. In the 50s and 60s, it was the Civil Rights Movement. In the 1970s, I was part of the small team that reconstructed the American military from the elitist conscription organization of Vietnam. I'm a vet. And into the all-volunteer meritocracy we have today. In the 80s, it was the citizen diplomacy movement to create back channels between the Soviet Union and the United States, and through all of that, the consciousness movement that became part of it became the environmental movement. And I got interested in how do these things, why do some things succeed and other things don't? And so I started looking at changes, and I went back to the beginning of the 20th century because I thought, if I go back any earlier than that, the culture is just too different to really understand. Although I ended up, as I've said already, going back to the abolitionists particularly. But I started looking at these changes, and then I looked at them all over the world, and I began reading academic research about these kinds of changes. And what I saw was there were these eight principles. Now, why there are eight, I can't tell you that. But there are eight principles that almost all the successful social transformational movements work out, just like Tom did. I mean, you know, he's a young boy. He figured it out. You come to this because I guess you do whatever it is you're doing, and you realize that this works and that doesn't work. But in any case, the reason there are eight, I couldn't tell you, but that's the way it is. There are eight patterns of behavior that all of these successful movements work out themselves.
Do religions practice these eight laws?
Well, the Quakers do,
right.
But no, not as a general proposition. No. No, I mean, look at all the bloodshed that has been spilt in the name of religion. I mean, whether you're talking about the Inquisition or you're talking about ISIS, all of those are religiously based. So no, religion, this has nothing to do with religion. This has to do with individual character and beingness. That's the key to it.
Next up, let's go to Jeff in Louisville, Kentucky, east of the Rockies. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Stuart, I think I've got I've had some exceptions to what you said. I think you said that FDR created the middle class. Did I hear that right?
I'm sorry?
Did FDR?
Did you say that FDR created the middle class earlier in the
show? Well, I mean, they created it by creating the whole post-war structure was a result of creating the GI Bill and GI Housing Bill.
But you were saying Benjamin Franklin created the middle class, Steve.
No,
Stephen,
no.
Right?
What I said
with
was...
With his banking.
Let me be very clear. Benjamin Franklin began the process of creating a middle class because, unlike many of the other founders, he did not see the United States as being a country that was ruled by an elite. He talked George Washington, for instance, out of not having hereditary titles, which after the war, the officers who had served Washington came to him and they wanted something like Sir that would be a hereditary title, and Franklin talked him out of it. Franklin's idea, because he was a working class guy, you know, he started out as he only had a tiny education. He started out as a printer. His father was a tanner. And he understood that the key to a successful democracy is a strong middle class. And he, in his will, he spells this out very clearly, what he calls virtuous citizens, by which he meant people who were committed not only to their well-being, but the well-being of society in general. And you can go back and find his will. I mean, he creates the micro lending. He starts out with these. He plans 200 years into the future. Think about this. This is a guy. He's 83 years old. He's sitting under his little mulberry tree behind his house in Philadelphia, and he's just come back from getting the most autocratic monarch in Europe, King Louis XVI, to fund an American revolution. It all ran through his personal bank account. He comes back, he knows he's dying, and he says, I want to do something for my country. And he creates this 200-year program, which is still running.
What happens if none of these laws are adhered to? And
you
people...
chaos.
That's
and authoritarianism, all right. And elitism.
And Hitler,
yes. And what's happening, a neo-feudalism, where you have a tiny, tiny, tiny group of people who have all the wealth, and you have everybody else who's just basically a serf.
Let's look at Hitler for a moment and go through these eight steps real quickly.
Well, okay, but let me just give you a story to make exactly your point, George.
All right.
After the war, they went to Carl Jung, you know, the great psychoanalyst.
Yeah.
And they said to him, how is it possible that this second-rate painter, a guy who never rose above corporal in the army, how did he possibly come to power to control the most sophisticated culture in Europe, which Germany was? And his answer was, to understand what happened, you must know that Hitler did not lead the German people. Hitler was the German people. He was the angry, resentful id of the German masses as a result of the Treaty of Versailles. And that's why George Marshall, at the end of the Second World War, created the Marshall Plan, a very different way of dealing with a post-war period than had ever been tried before. And look at its success.
Okay, so let's throw Hitler into this batch for a moment. Intention.
Okay.
Did he have intention on the things he did?
Hitler?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Goals. Did he have goals?
Yes, absolutely. Read Mein Kampf.
All right. Things that weren't reached in his lifetime? I'm not sure.
Well, no, he was not successful. That's the thing about violent change.
And he wanted credit. He wanted acknowledgement.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
He wasn't equal. There was no equality with him.
No.
There was no nonviolence.
Yes. That's why he didn't only last it.
He was not the same in his private self. He was totally different, right?
Absolutely.
And he had no integrity.
That's right. He's the counterexample of the eight laws.
Yet he appeared to succeed with himself and his nation for a few years.
Yes, I mean, that's
and then it caved in.
If you look at these, if you look at changes like National Socialism or Communism, they don't last very long. You know, National Socialism only lasted, well, depending on how you calculate it, from 1930 to 1945. He became chancellor in 33. So, you know, I mean, 10, 20 years. Communism, this huge monolith that when we were boys, you know, communism was this great thing that was terrifying the world. It only lasted 73 years. With a single person's lifetime. It began and ended within a single person's lifetime.
Next up, we've got Andrea in Indiana, first-time caller. Hello, Andrea. Go ahead.
Amen. Thank you for calling me Andrea. Anyway, but I just want to say amen and thank you, Hitler, for creating a group of people who know that you're not right.
That's right.
Going on. Yes, amen. And, oh, my God, I've got like 15 pages of notes just since 3 a.m. So the eight laws are common denominator, and then number two it didn't come through. What was number two?
Goals.
The eight laws, you can get them in my book, The Eight Laws of Change.
I know, I'm going to buy your book. Can you just tell me what number two?
No, I'm going to tell you another place you can get them. You can go to academia.edu. And search on my name, and you can get them there. You can just download the eight laws. It won't cost anything. Which law are you interested in?
Number two, I think.
Number two.
The individuals in the group may have goals, but they may not have cherished outcomes.
Amen. Okay, see, you all know that the prince of the power of the air is discriminated that for me. Okay, may not have, amen, okay, hang on.
There you go. We don't have time for you to write all that down. So give us the direction again, Stephen, for people to go.
You can go to Amazon or bookstores, The Eight Laws of Change. The book is in three parts. The first part is what it is, what these eight laws are, and how they work. The second section of the book is stories of people like Benjamin Franklin or the founding of Greenpeace, people who've actually done this and been successful. And the third portion of the book is the neuroscience and social science on why these things work, because they have a scientific basis. This isn't just something I cooked up in my head.
And how do you apply this to yourself? How do you go through these eight steps? Well, no, anybody in general.
I use these laws in my life. When I go out to the market, my wife and I have a list of companies whose products we don't buy because they are polluters, because they don't treat their employees well, because they outsource and take jobs out of the United States and send them overseas. So we have a list of companies that we just don't buy their products. And that's one thing. when I deal with people, the first question I ask myself is, what is the compassionate and life-affirming choice here? And I make that choice. I do just exactly what I'm talking about. It has transformed my life, and that's why I wrote this book, because I could see it work not only in my life, but in the lives of hundreds of other people who I saw putting these eight laws to work.
Are all successful people practicing these eight laws?
Well, if what by successful you mean rich people, no. If by successful you mean people who are recognized for their integrity and their commitment to the general wellness of society, yes.
Because we know there are some very wealthy people who do not do these eight things.
Oh, of course. This is not about money.
No.
This is not about money. This is not about fame. This is about creating well-being for yourself and society as a whole.
International Line, Jeffy in Vancouver, Canada. Hey, you're Jeffy. Go ahead.
I'm a little bit disappointed. That doesn't give me more than 2 minutes or so.
So you want me to put you on hold, and I'll get you later.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Okay. Just hang there, because Jeffy probably wants to talk to you for a little longer. But there's another Jeffy in Danville, Virginia. Hey, Jeff, go ahead.
How you doing, Joe?
Good, sir. How about you?
Doing good.
Good. Go ahead.
I've been listening to your guest talking, and I'm, you know, as a Christian myself, I definitely believe in following these laws. But what I do want to bring attention to, and maybe it's just an inherent, you know, flaw in man, in the nature of man, but what ends up happening a lot of times, and I'm sure your guests can agree with this, it's like, you know, with the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King made very good points, and he did a lot of great things. But it seems like society as a whole now has shifted more to the Malcolm X side than the Martin Luther King side. Yeah. And see, in my looking at it, and like I said, it may be an inherent flaw in man, but there's more of a desire to rule and be in power than to find equality. So whereas at one time it was about equal rights and equality, it seems like we've shifted in society to, instead of just wanting to be equal, wanting the world to revolve around us or have power within a certain group. And it's like I've noticed, you know, when you were talking about the LGBT community, you know, the desire at one time was just, hey, we want to have equal rights for this, or we want to be able to do this for, you know, our this and this. And what it has shifted to is anybody that disagrees with me is absolutely, he needs to not speak and needs to be silenced. And it's got to the point where the LGBT community as a whole that I've dealt with are some of the most vile and hateful people I have ever met in my entire life.
Well, you will find that if people do not agree, they will not calmly talk to you about it. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, our final segment with Stephen Schwartz. Stephen, would you give out your websites, then we'll go to the rest of the calls.
Sure. www.schwartzreport.net, that's S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z, .net, that's my daily web publication. I give it away, it's free, you can get it. It tracks trends that are shaping the future. My book is The Eight Laws of Change. You get it on Amazon or in your bookstore. My personal website is www.stephanaschwartz.com. STEPHANASCHWARTZ.com. StephanaSchwartz.com.
Super. Okay, let's go to our international line now. Jeffy in Vancouver, Canada. There you go, Jeffy.
Thank you very much, George.
Sure thing.
I would be referring to some terms, and you are very good at checking facts. You could open up your Wikipedia and quickly check them or write them down later on. You can check them. There is a philosophical principle which is about 700 years old, and it's called Occam's Razor.
Occam's Razor, that's
and
right.
And it goes, among competing hypotheses, the one with the fewest assumption succeeds. Now, basically what Stephen has is a combination of two aspects. The first four laws are the laws necessary for change. the last four laws are laws to feel good. All you need is the first four laws. One of the most successful organizations in this world just uses the first four laws. It's called Islam. And Stephen said that that's a religion. You can talk about that. Well, all I'll say in answer to that is, if Lenin had called communism a religion, the West would have had a tough time navel-gazing. They wouldn't know how to handle communism. He made a mistake. He should have called it religion. Then West would have no defense at all, because there is freedom of religion. They can have all the communists they want in the country, and there's nothing that the country can do about it. Now, as far as the Gandhi's success is concerned, I've thought about it for a long time. How did he succeed? The reason was, at some point, the enforcing authorities, which were basically the Indian soldiers, if they refuse to enforce the law, the British can't do anything, and they just have to leave the country, because the number of British people in the country, many controlling the entire nation, was a very small percentage. They could fool the soldiers for the longest time by giving them good salary, by providing them some security and so on. Now, millions of these soldiers had come back from the Second World War, which means they could fire weapons, and they were becoming more and more aware of the injustice, which means the British had no way of enforcing. There was another Gandhi in the Balochistan province of Pakistan. He's referred to as Baloch Gandhi. He could not do that because all the soldiers were controlled by Punjabis in Pakistan, and there was no way he could succeed. And he just died, I mean, without any success at all. That's the principle behind nonviolence. Nonviolence succeeds only if you can prick the conscience of the majority of the people. Otherwise, it does not succeed. It succeeded in 1965 because Martin Luther King, by being beaten, by being imprisoned, was able to shock the soul of the nation. And then the change occurred. It did not occur in the 100-year period from 1864 to 1964. So you have to take the time, and that's the mechanism. It's not purity of spirit. It's not religion or purity of thought, etc. Gandhi may have fooled himself into believing that, but the actual analysis shows why it worked. Now, I have some concerns. For example, Stephen says, please bear with me for a moment.
Sure, absolutely. You've taken your notes. You've done well.
Occupy broke down because there were no spokespersons. And Stephen is contradicting himself. Because, as a matter of fact, Stephen makes it one of the laws that you need equality. And the Occupy movement was trying the hardest. They didn't want any leaders. As a matter of fact, they did not even want to speak loudly. They had this funny style that one person will address the assembly, and the next, the people 20 down, rows down, they'll repeat that statement. So
all right. Hold on, Jeffy, for 1 second. Let's let Stephen answer some of these before we get too long into this. Go ahead.
Well, Jeff, I mean, most of the things that you've said are in support of the eight laws. I mean, your point about Gandhi, for instance. Yes, that's exactly what happened. The consciousness of the military changed, and Gandhi knew that. He changed the consciousness of the country. He made Indians proud to be Indian. The British chose to leave India. They weren't forced to leave India. And the reason that they chose it is that he changed consciousness. The same thing is true of Martin Luther King. King understood the same principles Gandhi did. And that was that, yes, he had to make a sacrifice. He went to jail. He changed the consciousness. I was there. I witnessed all this. He changed the consciousness of the country. He changed Lyndon Johnson's consciousness, for one thing. And Johnson recognized, and this is a historical fact, he understood that he was probably sacrificing his political career by signing the Voting Rights Act, and he did it anyway. And the reason he did was that he came to understand that King was right. It was only equality would promise a positive future for the United States. If this issue of civil rights was not resolved, it was going to tear the country apart. It had torn the country apart once before, and he understood that. So most of these examples that you're giving, I completely agree with you, because they are in complete support of the eight laws. I didn't, you know, the business about the goals but not cherished outcomes. When you hold an intention, you have a goal. In the case of Gandhi, it was that India would be a free and independent country. Or in Martin Luther King's case, it was that African Americans would have equality, that being born white would not of itself confer privilege. When you look at those things, all of them change because the consciousness of the country changes. As you said, it pricks the consciousness. Now, how that happens, how that plays out minute to minute, that's the cherished outcome part. You cannot have a cherished outcome because you don't know what the other players are going to do. All you can do is be true to the fundamental integrity, which is life-affirming. And that's what all of these leaders did. That's what great spiritual leaders do. I mean, if you look at Jesus's message, you know, greater things than I have done, so shall ye do, that you must love God and love your fellow, and in that is the whole of the law of the prophets. I mean, you see this, you can look at the Buddha, you can look at any person who has. We didn't have time tonight to get into the role of these epiphany experiences that they play, but all of these changes occur because one individual, it begins with one person, they have a change in consciousness and they articulate it in a way that makes it attractive to other people who are quickened by it, and then they act on it. And that's why this is a change in beingness. It's a change in the gestalt of the culture. And when that happens, things happen. You can see it in gender equality. You can see it in women's rights. You know, I mean, the United States, there are women who have run countries all over the world, including India. For the first time, we, in whatever it is, 240 years, we are putting forward a woman. Forget about the individual woman. The point I'm trying to make is that we are, for the first time, are really considering as a country that we can have a woman be our leader. I mean, that's an extraordinary shift.
It's dramatic.
Regardless
of your politics and
exactly
what you think about her individually, you're absolutely right, Stephen. But I'm not sure Gandhi would succeed today. What do you think?
Oh, I think he would.
You do?
Absolutely. You can see this happening. You can look at countries that are making choices. I've written paper after paper, research papers, looking at those cultures which are committed to well-being, who make wellness their first priority as opposed to making profit their first priority. I mean, I would argue that the central problem we face as a country is that we only have one social priority, and that's profit. We don't have wellness, well-being, as a social priority. And if you look at the comparison between what our social outcomes are and the social outcomes in countries that are choosing wellness, what you come away with is one absolutely ironclad principle. Wellness-oriented social policies are always, I cannot find an example that is a counterexample. They are always cheaper, more efficient, more effective, easier to implement, nicer to live under, and more enduring. I cannot find, and I've been looking now for several years, a counterexample. Wellness-oriented policies are cheaper. They're more efficient. They happen faster. You can look at it over and over again. This is a problem of if you deal with a world that is based in facts, and you look at facts, the facts are very clear. Creating wellness creates prosperity, creates health, creates equality. All of those things we aspire to, they all flow out of, just as Benjamin Franklin said, creating a society that is oriented toward well-being.
Next up, let's take a few more calls. Barbara in Los Angeles. Hi, Barb. Go ahead. Welcome to the show.
I wanted to talk briefly about a friend of mine that was in the nuclear freeze movement, and that was a real passion of his, and he had come out of the Quakers. He wrote speeches for the nuclear freeze movement, and he's kind of an unsung hero. And later in his life, he would go to the local market and set up a folding table and distribute cards protesting nuclear war and have people sign them. And he did that every Sunday morning, and then he would send them off. And I just wanted to acknowledge him. His name was Harold Waterhouse, and he was really concerned about nuclear war, and he wanted to meet with Helen Caldicott, and he wanted to engage her. He was trying to do a movie about the horrors of nuclear war, and I just wanted to give him some credit, not listen off the air.
Well, thank you very much, and that an example of law number four. He did this because he had that intention, and he did it whether he got credit or acknowledgement, but I thank you for giving him acknowledgement.
You know, Stephen, as we wrap things up, we'll take a few more calls here. It seems like a lot of people would like to implement this. How do they get started?
You get started with the quotidian choice, just what I said earlier. You get up tomorrow morning and you say, from this day forward, I am going to be aware about the choice. I'm going to be conscious of the choices I am making and of the options that are available to me. I am going to consistently choose the one that is compassionate and life-affirming. Now, I know that sounds so simple. It doesn't cost any money. You don't have to join anything. It seems so simple it can't possibly be real. But if you look at the major social changes that have occurred in the last 20 years, all the stuff about women's equality and all of that occurred because individual, regular people without any money or any particular power or official position just decided to make a different choice. There is no power on earth more powerful than the collective intention of masses of humanity.
We've got Edward in Wyckoff, New Jersey now. Edward, take it away.
Well, I need a little more time, so I'll try to be as brief as late
yeah,
as
possible. Yeah, I may have to snip you, but go ahead.
Well, that'll happen. Let me observe first. A message from Thomas Jefferson: the foundation of America is not in immigration. The first Americans were not immigrants. They were founders. Benjamin Franklin was among them. And Thomas Jefferson warned that if they brought immigration into America, they would destroy the culture and the Constitution, and that is exactly what has happened.
Sir, everybody is an immigrant. Example. Every single founder. There is no...
But everybody's an immigrant. Everyone.
An immigrant. Even the Native Americans are immigrants. There were no people in North America. Everybody came from somewhere else, and every founder was either a direct immigrant themselves or the immediate descendant of an immigrant.
So what would we say to them then, huh?
What we would say, we're not doing a very good job of what they intended. They spent the summer of 1787 writing the Constitution, and what they had in mind was a country in which that was a democracy, a middle-class democracy, in which technologically sophisticated people could get ahead, where there was equality. They had a huge blind spot about slavery. And in fact, George Mason, who was one of the principal authors of the Constitution and the father of the Bill of Rights, stood up on the last day and said, I will not sign this document because it does not end the slave trade.
Well, he was right about that. Hey, Stephen, thank you. Always great to have you on the program. For Dan Galante, Donna Walker, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesor, Stephanie Smith, Chris Morrills, and George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.